Good morning. We have with us a student from Fort Atkinson High School. Will they please stand? Please be seated. And we have students from Platteville High School. Will they stand, please? And would you please be seated? Now, Jane Colwin, who's the state law librarian, her son Matt is supposed to be here, and I've been trying to see. See if I can identify you. You're especially welcome, and I don't see your mother in the courtroom, so I assume she's where she's supposed to be working. The students are here with us today with the Court with Class program. This is a program run by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. It is a national award-winning program. The students have been invited to join us for an oral argument. They've received briefs in the case, and as part of the program, they will meet with a justice of this court at noon after this argument is over. They'll be joined by other students who were here earlier in the day, and they will discuss the procedures of the court in deciding cases. They will not discuss the substance and substantive issues of the cases we're hearing today. The justice with whom they'll meet is Justice Butler, who sits to my far left. And seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. If there's anyone in the courtroom who needs a summary of the case we're about to hear, the marshal will provide one. Just raise your hand. Got a couple.
Two takers.
And everyone, not only the students, but everyone's invited to join Justice Butler after this case. I will call our second case for today, 03-2306, State versus Thomas H. Bush. Representing Mr. Bush is Robert G. LaBelle, Attorney LaBelle.
Good morning, Chief Justice and members of the court. I'm Attorney Robert LaBelle, and I represent Mr. Bush in this action. This may eventually be called Bush 3, because this is about the third time it's come into some form of litigation. Mr. Bush was initially the subject of a 980 petition, I think, in 1997. It resulted in a commitment decision that was reversed based on a finding that the jury instruction failed to require the finding of much more likely than not as far as the standard. It was then retried, and it was appealed. It was then partially reversed based on a Thiel violation for failure to prove the 90-day rule. When the case came back for the Thiel remand, Mr. Bush filed a petition for discharge. Various pretrial motions were filed, including the motion that is the subject of this particular litigation. The trial court denied the motion. The Thiel issue was resolved. Mr. Bush went to trial on the discharge petition, and eventually, again, that was denied, and he was recommitted. This particular issue that the court accepted the petition on, I believe, is of extreme importance for the following reason. 980 litigation is in its infancy. It's basically, by analogy, in its maiden voyage. It's less than 11 years old. Every time we turn, there's a change, there's a variation. And this is actually the shakedown cruise. The issue here that this court is going to resolve is, at what point in time is finality the driving force in appellate litigation in 980 cases? It's my belief that when the Court of Appeals determined that Escalona was applicable and that the principles of Escalona was applicable to 980, that they erred. In the briefs that were filed, the state basically attempts to say that what the Court of Appeals did is they really didn't apply Escalona, and they really didn't apply 970-406. What they did was they took the reasoning from Escalona, and they applied the reasoning to 980 litigation. I hate to be a little liberal here, or literal, I should say, but basically if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck and it sounds like a duck, it is a duck, and that's exactly what the Court of Appeals did. So the question now becomes whether Escalona is applicable. If Escalona is applicable, is it applicable on a prospective or a retrospective basis or retroactive basis? Are there overriding principles when you attack the constitutionality of a statute that should allow, irrespective of Escalona, an attack on this particular statute? And finally, assuming that Escalona does not preclude this particular constitutional challenge, does the statute require proof of a recent overt act? In this particular case, when you talk about applications of 980, you have to look at the developments of the law. And through case law, through case decisions of this Court and the Court of Appeals, through statutory changes, there have been constant modifications of the 980 procedure and substance. You can look only to decisions in Thiel, where there was basically a challenge to the automatic commitment. You can look to Rachel. You can look to Crane, which was decided by the United States Supreme Court, dealing with the voluntariness. There were other decisions, Curiel, dealing with the standard of much more likely than not. Then after that, the statute sort of tinkered with things and went back to the more likely than not standard. And I point to that particular issue because there are going to be issues that I assume are going to be addressed by this Court in upcoming litigation. I don't know of any specific case, but I can well imagine that the application or retroactive application of Chapter 9, which changes the much more likely than not standard to more likely than not, is going to come before this Court. Similarly, I'm aware that there are now mandatory requirements of polygraph testing, and there's pretest and post-test interviews. And during the course of treatment, which that is considered to be a part of, there's going to be a requirement of absolute disclosure of all prior offenses. So the question is going to be, again, posed to this Court, I presume, in the future, of when is it a violation of Fifth Amendment privilege when, as a condition or precondition of treatment completion, you have to disclose all offenses, whether they've been litigated, whether they've been resolved or not. So it's with those underpinnings that this particular issue has to be resolved by the Court. The issue in Escalona is whether the
Before you get to the issue of Escalona, the recent overt act requirement that you're arguing for, at what point in time, at the time of the initial commitment under the sex crimes law, at the time of the petition for discharge?
At the time that the petition was actually filed.
The petition? Which petition?
The original petition, not the discharge petition. And that's the way the motion was phrased, was that when the original petition came in, there was no demonstration either on the petition on its face or through the course of litigation that there was a recent overt act. It wasn't simply a question of, well, this is a discharge hearing, so there's a different context, because Mr. Bush had been in continuous custody since 97 in the original petition. So I couldn't have argued for the discharge hearing that somehow there was a lack of intervening act.
All right. And if we're talking about the initial petition for commitment, that's where we're looking at the recent overt act.
Correct.
Was this raised at the time of the initial commitment?
No.
This particular issue?
No, it was not. And so the facts are very clear. Bush was convicted, was ultimately released, I believe, in 92 on parole. He was transferred to a different state. While he was on parole, he picked up an OWI. That eventually was dismissed, or he was acquitted, I don't remember which. And he was then brought back to this state on an extradition proceeding, and he was the subject of a revocation proceeding because he still was on parole. He was then revoked for the, for lack of a better term, the administrative violation, the rule violation of supervision, as opposed to committing a recent overt act or any sexualized behavior.
Well, let's see. When he was originally released and went to Georgia.
Georgia.
Was the act in place then?
No, it was not. He was released, I believe, in 92. He was then recommitted. The act went into effect July of 94, I believe. And then this petition came down in 97.
What is it that you're arguing the law ought to require?
With respect to the recent overt act?
Yeah.
It's our position, and again, we are relying in part on the Albrecht decision. And the Albrecht decision is the Supreme Court's of Washington's decision, which basically says that due process requires that when a person is not in continuous custody, as opposed to an individual who is in continuous custody, that for that person there must be proof of a recent overt act which intervened between the release date and the time that the commitment petition was filed. The theory of Albrecht is simply that if somebody is worthy of community release, that means that his dangerousness has abated, at least for that purpose. And if that's the case, then there should be a demonstration that there is something new that is on the forefront. There's something new that has occurred that would justify the filing of the SVP petition. And it's our position that that is, in fact, what should be required by the statute.
Now, the argument on the other side is basically Washington has a statute, as I recall, that says that requires the state to prove a recent overt act. We don't have that statute in Wisconsin.
That's correct.
So that's basically a main difference. But are you saying despite the fact we don't have it, we should go ahead and use the Albrecht
test? I'm saying that, yes, Your Honor. I'm saying that because of the genesis of Albrecht. Albrecht was based on Young. And in Young, the Supreme Court of Washington again found that due process required that there be proof of a recent overt act. In direct response to that decision, the Washington legislature changed the statute to require proof of a recent overt act for any prior to the filing of an SVP statute for anyone who was not in continuous custody.
And that was a 2002 decision, as I recall.
Yeah, Albrecht.
Albrecht, yes.
2002 or 2003, right. Correct.
Now, was the issue of recent act and the constitutionality of the Sex Offender Act litigated in Post and Carpenter?
Certain issues were litigated in Post. Certain issues were litigated in Carpenter.
Well, was this issue litigated in either one of them?
It is my position that the discrete due process challenge that we've lodged, was not addressed in the Post and the Carpenter decisions. The decisions, in fact, addressed the requirement of a recent overt act in the context of an equal protection argument. Similarly, in the next decision, there was a challenge to whether there was a requirement of proof of a recent overt act in order to successfully get a bindover in a 980 proceeding.
Let me just ask this. Suppose he had never been released in 92. And he stayed in prison all that time and now seeks release. Do you have the same argument about due process requiring a recent overt act?
Absolutely not.
Okay, that's my point.
That's what the Albrecht court says. It would be ridiculous to require somebody to prove that, and I agree with that completely.
Don't you? Well, how come you don't have an equal protection charge then? We're requiring one thing to commit one group of people and not requiring it to commit another group of people for the same problem.
Because the court decision where there was an equal protection challenge when that was particularly argued, I think the argument was, well, there's no justifiable difference between those two people. They're similarly situated. And it was resolved by this court. The equal protection challenge did not fly.
Mr. LaBelle, don't you think that the language used by the U.S. Supreme Court in Kansas versus Crane and the language used by the majority of this court in the Laxton decision cover what's necessary for a commitment and do not in any way, shape, or form require a recent overt act? Haven't we actually at least implicitly ruled on what you're talking about?
In direct response to your question, I would indicate that the recent overt act was not raised in either context, either Crane or Laxton. I would agree with you that there were discussions about dangerousness and what constitutes dangerousness. I would agree with you that there was an analysis of what constitutes an inability to control behavior, but there was never particular argument either that was presented or that was responded to by this Court dealing with whether recent overt act is also reflective of a person's future dangerousness. And it's our position that that should be what is required.
Now your client has had, there have been, on that issue about dangerousness and the assessment by the, I think there's been two assessments, maybe I'm wrong, there have been a couple of jury trials where they found him to be still dangerous. And I'm just trying to get a handle on the facts, but there have been at least two jury trials after the mistrial you talked about because of the inappropriate instruction where there has been a finding of dangerousness.
Actually, three.
Oh, there have been three. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, three trials, right.
There were three full-blown jury trials. There was never a mistrial.
Right. Right.
Yes, and that's correct. There were obviously conclusions by the jury that he was, first of all, proper for the original petition, second of all, again proper, and third of all, in continued need of treatment. Therefore,
and I think Justice Crooks asked the question because Laxton dealt with that, something that would shock the conscience of, or it was my memory is, but it dealt with what was necessary to confine someone.
That's true. But again, maybe I'm focusing in on the precise wording that I'm using in this argument, but there was never nobody ever addressed that precise issue.
The facts in those cases, any of them involved somebody who was in as a sexual predator, released, was out on parole, violated parole on a non-sex charge, and now is a 980. Is that fact situation peculiar to this case?
No. No. I mean, I think that you're saying somebody who has been revoked goes back in on a sexual assault charge.
No, doesn't.
I'm sorry.
Same as this case. He didn't go back in on a sexual assault case. He went back in on drunk driving,
right.
Violation of other conditions of parole, right? I'm asking, in any of the 980 cases, do you have the fact situation you have here?
So I think it's not inconsistent with what happens on a regular basis.
Because his last conviction there was an elderly nursing patient, was that the last one in 88? Second degree sexual assault. Then he was released in 92 to go to Georgia and then violated his probation, correct? Okay, correct.
Counsel, why isn't a recent overt act more appropriately the function of a defense that is, it's raised as a defense to the issue of continuing dangerousness? And the defense in the jury trial is, hey, he's not still dangerous. Look, he was free for a while. Nothing happened, and that should be a good indicator of no continuing dangerousness.
I think your point is well taken. I try a lot of these cases, and what happens is that the prosecution comes in and says, well, yeah, he hasn't done anything in the last 17 years or 18 years, and yeah, he was out for a long period of time, but while he was on supervision, he had a bunch of problems with his probation officer. While he was on supervision, he had other conduct which is considered to be antisocial, and that's reflective of his future dangerousness to reconvict in a sexually violent way. And so to obviate that type of proof where juries are supposed to make quantum leaps between non-sexualized conduct and future dangers to commit a sexual act, we're asking that there be a specific requirement that a recent overt act be proven. Getting back to
this is only in cases where there has been a release of some kind?
Under Albrecht, that's correct. And Albrecht was basically, the situation was this. Albrecht occurred after the requirement was put into place that there be a recent overt act, after the legislature changed the statute. And Albrecht got released to community supervision. Albrecht got involved in some non-sexualized administrative violations. And so the Department of Corrections, or the Washington State equivalent, came to them and said, well, here, we will give you what's called an ATR, an alternative to revocation, which is 120 days, in exchange for not revoking you and going back to prison. And so Albrecht said, fine, went into custody doing this 120 days, and just about at the expiration of the 120 days, they hit him with an SVP petition. And so the question is, well, is he in continuous custody from the underlying offense? And they're saying no, because you were released to community confinement. And that's how the situation arose in that case. It's very similar to the situation in Bush. Albrecht was out for a very, very brief period of time, just like Bush. Bush was only out for, I think it was 29 days before he violated, at least according to the Department of Correction, and was then ultimately reinstitutionalized.
I'm just having trouble grasping the theory here. Mr. Bush was released in 1992, before the sexual predator law was passed, Chapter 980 was adopted.
Right.
All right. And then he comes back, and he's in custody from 1992, I think, till 1997. Isn't that right?
Yes.
You're not asking, I don't believe, that he has to commit some act during the time he's incarcerated.
Right. Not at all. But what we're saying is, and what I'm saying is, that Mr. Bush was reincarcerated not because of a sexually violent act. And if you assume, and I think it is a logical assumption, that the reason why he was granted release was because he was deemed, one, to be trustworthy enough to comply with the conditions, two, he was deemed not to be of sufficient risk to reoffend. If you assume that, and I do believe it's a proper assumption, if he was revoked for non-sexualized conduct, then there's nothing that is new that would justify the petition. And so, therefore, it's our belief that there has to be proof of a recent overt act. Had Bush gone out and sexually assaulted somebody, we clearly would not be having this argument.
Well, do we have to wait for that? I'm looking at page 3 of the state's argument, where they use Bush suffers from paraphilia, a mental disorder as described by Chapter 980. Bush is at the highest risk of reoffense of all offenders because he is a psychopath as well as suffering paraphilia with deviant sexual arousal. I mean, that apparently was established. I assume that was established at one of the jury trials. It says see the record 29212, but that's what the state's description of your client is.
Correct. And I would agree with you that there is, I think it's the Sprosty case that stands for the proposition that if you're going to reinstitutionalize, you don't have to have another sexual assault.
We've been discussing the Sprosty case, yes.
So we, in the defense bar.
let me ask you, Silverdale. Let's just say you win on this point. In this court. What about all the people who have been incarcerated for sexual offenses for 10, 15 years and who haven't committed a recent overt act during that time? What are they going to come to this court and say?
Who eventually become the subject of an SVP petition?
Yeah.
Well, the response is the exact words that were used by the Washington Supreme Court, which is you don't want to have a ridiculous result, and I'm not chastising the court, I'm saying, but you would have a ridiculous result if you said, while this guy is sitting here in prison for 15 years, we want the state to prove that he went out and committed a sexual assault, because that's not going to happen in an institution. In all likelihood. I mean, I will agree with you that there's that rare occasion that somebody's going to have access to a child in a prison, but more likely than not, he's not going to be engaged in sexualized behavior in an institution. And so that's why the distinction was drawn between people who are in continuous custody for sexual act, as opposed to those people who have been released into the community.
This case only comes up if he's been released into the community. And while released in the community, does not commit a sexual act, but otherwise violates a condition of parole.
Exactly.
How long was the period of time here for Mr. Bush? How long was he out on the street, if you will?
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, 29 days. It's a very short period of time.
So we'd zero in on that 29 days and say that if he didn't do anything wrong during that 29 days, then you can't proceed against him under 980.
I think it's one way of looking at it. By the same token, we also have to put it in the proper context, which is that he was revoked for non-sexualized conduct. So had he not been revoked for an administrative violation, arguably he'd still be at liberty.
But when he was revoked, he went back into prison for sexual conduct, for his sexual assault on a elderly patient at a nursing home. Isn't that correct?
For the balance of the unfinished, up until mandatory release, correct.
Right.
Would your argument be the same if someone didn't quite have the longevity of your client, that is, was released and messed up after 4 days? And brought back in on a non-sexual offense, and you say, well, within 4 days, there was no recent overt act. And then, of course, once I say 4 days, I can go to 2 days, and then I can... So that my point is, you know, your rule that you're advocating would probably cover 4 days.
It would have to, because...
Or 4 years. Your point, the reliance is not that he was a good person, or at least not sexually violent, within the short or long time that he was out on release, but that the parole board made a decision that he was not dangerous to the public. That's why they released him.
That's correct.
Therefore, at that time, you have a government decision that he is okay for release. Therefore, your position, if I understand it, is why the devil did the government change its mind now? And your answer is they have no grounds to change their mind now as to his dangerousness for sexual conduct. He may be a danger for drunk driving, but you can't keep him in on that basis.
That is correct.
A summary of your position?
That is correct.
Counselor, but how would they be looking at whether he was sexually dangerous when he was out because the law wasn't even in effect?
Well, because I think it's implicit in a parole grant, especially with sexual offenders, even in 92, that the driving force and whether or not to grant a discretionary parole at that time was, is this person still dangerous? Has this person had the requisite amount of treatment? Is the setting into which he's going to be released sufficient to ameliorate any risk that he poses?
Yeah, but certainly the standard was different than what we have in the statute now, where you have to prove a mental defect and that someone is currently dangerous.
Well, what was the standard? Is there something in the statutes in 92 that says the parole board may? Because this is not a mandatory release. If a mandatory release, we wouldn't be arguing, right?
Right.
It's discretionary release. Is something in the statutes, 92, that says when you should release?
No. You had the 25% where you had eligibility and you had the criteria that was laid out in the statute and it hadn't changed.
What are the criteria?
Basically, the danger to the public, whether the person has served sufficient time, whether he's had treatment needs attended, or I shouldn't say, whether he's had programming needs attended to, his adjustment in the facility.
So, dangerousness is one of them.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's my understanding it is. Yes.
Go ahead.
Right. Thank you, Mr. LaBelle. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Wellman.
Before you even begin,
I get to say my name. I'm Sally Wellman, representing the state of Wisconsin. Please.
Oh, you.
In your brief, on page 3, While serving his 1998 prison sentence, Bush was released on parole on February 5, 1992, as a result of sentence modification. He was permitted to leave Wisconsin to participate in a behavioral medicine inpatient program in Atlanta, Georgia. You want to tell us anything more about the circumstances?
I would love to, but I don't know anymore. There's nothing more in the record. This is all based on the argument that was made during and the motion that Mr. Bush filed before his petition for discharge jury trial, asking this whole case be dismissed because there was no recent overt act. And I believe it was Mr. Bell, correct me if I'm wrong, was counsel for him at that point. He made his statement regarding these facts. The prosecutor added a couple of facts. I think it was the prosecutor who mentioned that there was a sentence modification motion first. And that's all we know. From this record, it is absolutely, you cannot draw the assumption or infer that it was a discretionary parole. It could just as easily have been a mandatory release date. And I guess I assumed that it was, and that the reason he came up for parole immediately then was because of the sentence modification. But none of that detail is in the record.
What was the length of Mr. Bush's initial sentence? Do we know that?
I don't recall. I don't know if that's in the record either. It may be in the initial petition, which is in the record, but I don't recall. And that's really the whole flaw of this theory of Mr. Bush's, is that for most of the sex predator cases, at least that I have seen, which have been quite a number during the first few years of the sex predator law, most of these men have been released on mandatory release date. They hit their mandatory release date. They get released. They get revoked, often not for a new offense, but for rule violations. Sometimes there's a new offense and it doesn't get charged out because he gets revoked anyway. They then recalculate a new mandatory release date. He serves to that. He gets released. He gets out. He gets revoked again. He's back. And ultimately, he reaches his maximum discharge date. And for those people for whom the sex predator law is applicable and for whom it existed, that's when the state files its petition. It can file it now since 1994, of course. It could, if this was a mandatory release date in 1992, it could have filed a sex predator petition at that point. But, of course, 980 didn't exist. So to make the assumption in this case that somehow substantive due process says that we have to prove a recent overt act occurred in a less than 8-week period in 1992 because the state made a judgment that Mr. Bush was safe enough to be released. We don't know that. We don't have that in this record.
This has to be a recent overt sexual act.
Well, I'm not quite clear if Mr. LaBelle is arguing that it just has to be something sexual, even though it might not constitute a sexually violent offense, or if it has to actually be a sexually violent offense.
Maybe I'm wrong, but isn't that what Albrecht required? I that's what I assume, that it was a recent overt act of sexual violence.
Or a threat, I think, to commit one. And I'm not sure. Well, in Albrecht, the other thing that I find, aside from the fact that, of course, it's not precedent and they do have a different statute, and I think the analysis in that case really mushed due process and the statute in a way that's very confusing. But the other thing is I just think they're wrong, even under Mr. LaBelle's theory, to say that there was no recent overt dangerous behavior in that case. Mr. Albrecht had been convicted and sentenced for sexual assault of children. One of his conditions was to have no contact with children. What he got revoked for was giving 50 cents to two little boys to either follow him home or let him follow them home. I don't remember which way it was. Now, that, in anybody's judgment, has got to be seen as a precursor of dangerous behavior. We don't want to have to wait until someone actually commits a sexual assault of an elderly woman in a nursing home or a little child on a playground. That's why we have the sex predator law in the first place. And for Mr. Bush, the fact that he was drinking and driving when he was supposed to be in a halfway house in Georgia after intensive sex offender treatment in a special, very specialized, well-recognized program in Georgia, tells us two things. One, to the extent that he has an overriding alcohol problem, alcohol is often a disinhibitor that with many, many sexual offenders is part of their sex offense pattern. And it shows us he can't obey the rules even for 8 weeks. That is relevant information ultimately in his whole package, but it certainly doesn't mean that we have to, that due process or even logic or reason would suggest that we have to prove a sexually violent act occurred during that 8 week period. I'm not quite sure what the, I'm not even sure if you were to try to define what it is that Mr. LaBelle wants you to say the Constitution says. I'm not sure what the recent means. I guess in this context he means recent in relationship to the almost less than 8 weeks that he was out on parole. But that's not recent in terms of his sex predator petition because that was filed 5 years later and he'd been continuously incarcerated for those 5 years. I think Albrecht not only is wrong, but it doesn't, if any Washington State case gives us guidance, it's the following case, which we discuss in our brief, which I think is pronounced Paschke, which is much more like our case in which the person was released early, you know, like in 88 or 89. He was out for a period of time. He got revoked. There was a sexual connotation to his behavior. He was making threatening and obscene phone calls, but it wouldn't constitute a sexual violent offense. Then he was back in for 5 years, and then they filed a sex predator petition. And in that case, the court said the Albright requirement of a recent overt act doesn't apply because he's been in custody for 5 years, and that's the situation with Mr. Bush. I also don't see how this court could hold the substantive due process requires a recent overt act in light of this court's decisions in Post and Carpenter and more recently in Laxton. Laxton is the most recent case that I'm aware of anyway, defining what is constitutionally sufficient showing of dangerousness. And that requires that the person have been convicted of a sexually violent offense, which is defined by statute what those offenses are, that he have a mental condition, which is an emotional or volitional disorder that predisposes him to commit acts of sexual violence, that disorder causes him to have serious difficulty controlling his dangerous behavior, and that disorder makes him dangerous because under the statute that Mr. Bush was committed under, it creates a substantial probability that he will engage in acts of sexual violence. That's what you need to show current mental disorder and dangerousness, which is all that substantive due process requires.
Now, and summarize your argument, at least to meet Mr. LaBelle's. This is not a case in which the record shows discretionary release on parole on the grounds that he's not dangerous to the public.
Correct.
Therefore, the argument that you need a recent act in light of the fact that there's been a government decision he's not dangerous falls.
Right.
Just on the facts of the case.
Right.
All right. And you don't think it, even if he had been out 2 years, that would make any difference, right?
No, right. I don't think it would make any difference.
Statute's good anyway. Any cases on that?
No.
Wisconsin?
No, because the only case where it was directly raised was Carpenter. And in Carpenter, although the court didn't use the term due process, I mean, the defense's whole argument as to why we should have to show a recent overt act that was based on Young, which was based on due process. So I think it's fair to read it as a due process case. There, Mr. Carpenter had been out on mandatory release before the sex predator law existed. He was out for 9 months, and he went back in. He didn't commit any rule violation of any kind. They just recalculated his mandatory release date and decided they'd done it wrong the first time. And that's why he was back in. 6 months later, he hit his maximum discharge date, and we filed a petition. And this court said because he was confined when we did that, Young's holding that if you're out on the street when the petition is filed, then you have to have a recent overt act. Now, I'm not suggesting that, I don't think we have to discuss or this court has to decide if a person were on the street when the sex predator petition were filed in Wisconsin, because The Wisconsin statute says within 90 days of release you have to file it, and Wisconsin has interpreted that in practice to mean 90 days before release. Now, the words of the statute, I suppose, in theory, could be read to mean 90 days after your release, but to my knowledge, the state has never filed a petition and has made a decision that not to interpret the statute that way.
All right. So as a matter of fact, you just disagree with them, and that might very well take care of that argument, might. What about Escalona?
Okay. I do want to make sure we discuss that a little bit at least. I think it's not fair to say that the Court of Appeals applied Escalona, because Escalona is a statutory construction case in large part, and the statute on its face doesn't apply to sex predators. So, and the Court of Appeals obviously knew that. What it says is we're looking at the reasoning, which is, and although they didn't cite the other cases that we cite in our brief, which are civil cases going way back to the 1898, I think, is the first one, it's a longstanding policy in, I'm sure not just in Wisconsin, but in jurisprudence, that we don't allow successive attacks on the same judgment in any venue, not in criminal and not in civil. So there's nothing really novel. I mean, it made it easy for the Court of Appeals to pick up on some of the language and rationale and policy of Escalona because it's out there and it has, you know, a fairly recent case, but it's not necessary. If Escalona didn't exist, the Court of Appeals could easily have reached the same ruling, relying on general jurisprudence policies that we don't allow successive attacks. Now, in this case...
But you've got State X Rel Skinkis versus Treffert that talks about the court's jurisdiction, facial constitutionality, challenges to a statute and how it impacts a court's jurisdiction. I believe there's language in that case that says the court has a duty to ascertain its own jurisdiction. And I understood from your brief you're arguing that we may have moved away from that line of cases. I wasn't sure if you were questioning the line of cases in the first instance or whether you were saying we've just moved from that point to a different point.
I'm saying both. I think that line of cases, for one thing, it's not even clear how far that line goes, because Skinkis itself was a challenge to the vagueness of the statute. There are subsequent cases that say, well, a facial constitutional challenge based on vagueness goes to subject matter jurisdiction, but other constitutional claims like due process and equal protection claims don't. And then there are cases, fairly recent cases, that just pick up on the Skinkis language without making any distinction. So at the very least, it seems to me if that rule is going to be retained, then we need to articulate, well, what constitutional facial challenges go to subject matter jurisdiction and why? And why would this kind of a substantive due process claim that the statute needs to have a recent overt act requirement, why would that go to subject matter jurisdiction? Now, the other thing, and then I also think that in light of the more recent, well, not necessarily time-wise more recent, but the other line of cases that says circuit courts in Wisconsin always have subject matter jurisdiction over any civil or criminal matter.
But that's subsequent to 1978. Prior to 1978, you had county courts, you had circuit courts, you had justices of the peace. Subject matter jurisdiction meant something very different prior to the amendment of the Constitution and subsequent to the amendment of the Constitution.
Right, but some of my if I think I'm correct, that many of the cases that still say a facial constitutional challenge goes to subject matter jurisdiction post-date that amendment. So that would still be inconsistent. And it seems to me that, I mean, there may be something going on that I'm just not getting out of these two lines of cases. It seems to me that if there is something that explains how disconnected they seem to be, you know, that ought to be articulated. Now, having said all of that, this Court doesn't have to go there at all because Mr. Bush clearly is not making a facial challenge. Because when you make a facial challenge, you're not allowed to look outside the face of the statute to your particular facts. And Mr. Bush is hinging his whole argument on his perception of his particular facts, which is that the parole board made a judgment that he was safe enough to be released. They released him, then they revoked him for a non-sexual offense. And that is not a facial challenge. It's only as an applied challenge.
Your brief, though, points out that this area of law in Wisconsin, at least, is mixed. And you talk about recent cases, our Chuchinsky case. I recall that case, and I do quite well. It would be an error for me to say that the facts of the case elude me. Anyway, in that case, we said clearly that a facial challenge to the constitutionality of a statute is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction and cannot be waived.
Right, right. That makes sense in a criminal case, because if the statute is unconstitutional so that there is no crime, then he cannot be tried and the court has no subject matter jurisdiction over the offense.
Well, even if that's correct, and I'm not sure that I agree with that theory, but that's much more narrow than what the cases say. The cases have broadened that to other constitutional challenges. It seems to me that if that theory is valid, it's only valid when the complaint alleges a crime not known to law, not something where you say, well, you know, the statute works okay in these situations, but then there's this one area, an equal protection challenge or a substantive due process challenge. It doesn't seem to me you're saying that there's no crime known to law then, or there is no crime, and therefore, you know, the court doesn't have jurisdiction. I still don't see what's gained by labeling that jurisdiction. And it seems to me if the statute is faulty in that way, then the statute is just faulty, and maybe he can't be convicted, but it doesn't go to subject matter jurisdiction. Well,
you got to pin something.
Well, he doesn't need a new term, maybe.
All right. I thought we might agree on that.
Ms. Wellman, I don't want to put words in Mr. LaBelle's mouth, and I hope I'm not misstating his argument, but maybe I misunderstood it, and so I want to make sure that we're talking the same language. You've argued that this is an as-applied challenge. Am I incorrect in reading his brief to assert that because the statute doesn't require a recent overt act as part of the statutory scheme, the statute on its face is unconstitutional? In other words, I know he's argued in the context of his facts, but unless I'm misreading, I thought what he's saying is that the statute has to require recent overt acts as part of the statute. Am I misreading that?
I think you're correct that that's what he's saying. I think he's incorrect, however, because the case law that we cite in our brief says for it to truly be a facial challenge, you have to be able to conclude that the statute would be unconstitutional in all circumstances and situations, and he's not claiming that. He's admitting that if the person had been in continuous custody, then no recent overt act would be required. But I think you're correct that that is his argument, as best I understand it. I did also just want to briefly discuss that the other theory I see Mr. LaBelle putting forth for why he should be allowed to raise this claim, even though he didn't raise it at any time challenging his initial petition or in his initial appeal of his initial commitment or even his second trial, pre-trial hearings, or his appeal from his second trial and second commitment. He didn't raise it until he was raising his own discharge petition. It's just because of the possible ramifications and length of a 980 commitment, that it could potentially be for lifetime if the person never improves to the point where they can be safely released. And it's our position that that just simply cannot be sufficient to throw out all the waiver and procedural bars that this court has recognized. In the first place, if that were the reasoning, then Escalona wouldn't apply to law in criminal context. It couldn't apply to life sentences, or, you know, many, many defendants have extremely long sentences that even though no one is for a lifetime, the aggregate is well beyond anybody's life expectancy. And so that theory just doesn't make sense. In addition, there are many other contexts in which a person, you know, the court's initial ruling has lifetime ramifications for that person. For example, if a person is committed under Chapter 51, now granted, in Chapter 51, in order to keep the person, the state has to keep reproving his dangerousness and mental condition, which is different than 980. But once he's in on a Chapter 980, the state can do an involuntary medication order. And some of those medications can have serious side effects. And if the person gets an involuntary medication order and then appeals that order, you know, he can challenge the medication order, the evidence that went into that, maybe even the statutory section that says you can do this as violating due process. but we would not say, well, you can go back and bring a new constitutional challenge to your underlying commitment under the theory that, well, if I'd never been committed, you couldn't make me take these medicines, and therefore I get to go back and reopen everything. If I understand Mr. LaBelle's theory, that because he's on discharge and he's still in under 980, he can then go continuously go back, no matter how long it is, and attack his original commitment. Under that theory, he'd be able to go back and attack his 1988 sexual offense conviction under a but-for theory, because he could say, well, if it weren't for that conviction, I wouldn't qualify for a 980 commitment, and I wouldn't still be incarcerated, and you would have to discharge me because I wouldn't meet the terms of the statute. And that just seems to me to be opening the door to new challenges and collateral challenges that is properly closed. Now, if there were a new, and he's saying, well, then how could a person ever bring a new challenge? Or, you know, as the statute and the law develops, there has to be a mechanism to raise these. Well, there is a mechanism. When there is truly a new challenge and the court makes its decision retroactive, either completely on direct and collateral review, or at least to people on direct review, you know, for example, if Laxon and Crane had gone the other way, and the courts had said, yes, state, you must prove, independent of the other factors you prove, you have to prove this person is totally unable to control himself, and made that fully retroactive, then, you know, Mr. Bush would be able to raise a habeas petition. So I don't think that our theory that he can't raise now the challenge that the statute is invalid because it didn't require a recent overt act on his discharge petition means that when there truly is a transformation of the law that this court has held to be retroactive, he wouldn't get the benefit of that.
Did the state argue the Escalona principles in the Court of Appeals, or did it just argue general waiver principles?
We argued Escalona as an analogy, as well as general waiver.
It's your position that Escalona does not apply to 980, is that correct?
It doesn't strictly apply because 974.06 doesn't strictly apply.
Let me ask you, I'll take a look at page 9 of your brief. I understood your argument to be that Escalona does not apply to 980 proceeding. And maybe I'm wrong. I mean, I'm not reading verbatim of the brief.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
This is what I was reading. Bush's argument lacks merit. This is the very first sentence on page 9.
Okay.
The Court of Appeals did not hold that Escalona applies to a 980 proceeding. Is it your, from that, that first sentence, or the first two sentences, are you arguing that Escalona applies to 980 proceedings?
No, I'm not. I'm arguing the reasoning and rationale of finality apply.
And to the extent that paragraph 12 and 13 of the Court of Appeals opinion can be read that it did hold that Escalona applies to 980, you would then necessarily have to advance that it is in error.
Right, if that's what it held. I don't think that's what it's saying. I think it's still analogizing. And, in fact, the first sentence of paragraph 13 is similarly the reasoning of Escalona should apply. And so that's what I think that, you know, they said from the get-go, and that's consistent throughout the case.
Is there anything you would change about the Court of Appeals decision?
I guess I didn't look at that in that light exactly. There is one slightly incorrect factual statement. In paragraph 3, the second sentence, or the second line as part of the first sentence, alleging Bush was still sexually violent, that still is, it shouldn't be in there. It was just alleging he was sexually violent.
And you would, I guess, not put in Albrecht at all because you don't think it's applicable.
Right. And, you know, I guess, you know, to the extent that they talked about Albrecht and, I mean, I think what they were, the way I read it is what they were addressing was that Mr. Bush was trying to use Albrecht as his sufficient ground, even if he were under an Escalona type statute that says, well, there's this general rule that you can't raise a new challenge that you could have raised on your direct appeal unless you have a sufficient reason. And he's saying my sufficient reason is this new decision. And we're saying that even under that theory, out-of-state case that's not controlling precedent and not binding in Wisconsin can't be a sufficient ground. Now, I suppose that brings us to the question of whether, if we're not strictly applying the Escalona because we're not strictly applying 974-06 because it doesn't apply to civil involuntary commitment cases and we're just relying on the common law and policies of finality in litigation, can this court similarly, could you recognize a sufficient ground if there were one? And I guess it would be my position that you could, under sort of an interest of justice approach, and that's similar to what this court did in, I think it's Schumacher, State versus Schumacher, where the court said, well, the Court of Appeals doesn't have authority to review a waived challenge to a jury instruction, but it can still reverse in the interest of justice. And so that's how you reach. So it seems to me that it's similar here. And, in fact, in Laxton, I mean, the parties didn't really dispute it, but in Laxton, because of the timing of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Crane, the whole argument that the state has to prove inability to control behavior was not raised until Laxton's petition for review. Now, granted, that was still in his direct appeal pipeline, but this court allowed him to do that, and we didn't object, even though he hadn't raised it earlier. So, I mean, I think if there were a case where there were truly an issue, certainly an issue of statewide importance that maybe would bring into challenge, you know, the very heart of the statute, you know, there are circumstances in which this court or the Court of Appeals could reach it in the interest of justice, so we're not precluding that. But certainly we don't see this case as falling within that very narrow exception.
Well, Escalona has a good cause exception.
Right, right. And it seems to me that there's no reason that logically that kind of exception wouldn't apply under a common law theory, too.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. And then we would ask the Court to affirm the Court of Appeals on the procedural grounds, but if you do reach the merits to hold that substantive due process does not require a recent overt act.
Thank you, Ms. Roman.
Thank you.
Mr. LaBelle.
Your Honor, I responded to your last question when I was making my argument that dangerousness was part of the discretionary parole decision, and I believe that is not necessarily a statutory requirement, but I think it's implicit that when there's a discretionary grant that the parole board is reviewing the circumstances and saying, hey, this person is appropriate for release into the community and doesn't present a risk that needs institutionalization. The state Wilcox asked a question about what's the definition of recent overt act, and that definition, according to the RCW, which is the Washington State Code provision 71.09.020.10, is as follows. Recent overt act means any act or threat that has either caused harm of a sexually violent nature or creates a reasonable apprehension of such harm in the mind of an objective person who knows of the history and mental condition of the person engaging in the act. And so clearly an operating under the influence case does not apply.
Counselor, do you agree with opposing counsel that you cannot tell from the record whether this Mr. Bush was released on discretionary release or whether he bumped up against a mandatory release date?
From the record in this case, that's correct. I have my own.
Actually, maybe I'm misconstruing it, but I believe Justice Brasher pointed out that the conviction was in 1988 and the discharge at the end of the sentence was in 1997. So unless you've got some absconding that tolls the time, mandatory release is 75%. So if he's out in 92, it has to be discretionary.
Right. I would be arguing outside of the record because I've handled Mr. Bush's case for eons, but I think that assessment is correct. The other thing is that the state says, well, you know, take a look at Albrecht, and even if you thought that Albrecht was marginally applicable in this particular case, it's been eviscerated by Paskey. Paskey case had very, very unique facts. And in Paskey, the Court of Appeals, and it's not a Supreme Court decision, specifically says, we're making this decision based on the unique facts presented in Paskey. And more importantly, it points out to the fact that, in essence, what Paskey did when he was actually revoked is he committed something which constitutes a recent overt act. So it satisfied the statute. So that's one of the reasons why they felt that Albrecht in that case did not apply.
Mr. LaBelle, I think both sides agree that 974.06 does not apply by its terms. Why shouldn't the court just construct a rule that sort of court-developed rule that parallels 974.06?
Because I believe 980 litigation is extremely unique, if that's a correct assessment. It is unusual in the litigation in this state. It's unusual throughout the country for the 17 states that have it. It is developing as we speak. When we use the term, when I do 980 litigation, the actual concepts that are applicable to adjudicating a person, it's like nailing jello to the wall. It's constantly in a state of flux. So to put specific limitations on when a litigant over the course of time can raise an issue, I think would be inappropriate. I think it's inappropriate because by its very nature, 980 litigation has an ongoing, almost endless process. It has virtually no finality. Unfortunately, that's one of the byproducts of the way the legislation was enacted. And so for that reason, I don't think the court should put limitations or create a bright line process by which attacks on the underlying process or the underlying commitment should be precluded. I'm asking that this court reverse the decision by the Court of Appeals. I think the Court of Appeals relied upon Massiman and Kramer incorrectly. Those cases do not in any way, shape, or form, in my opinion, support its argument that 974.06 or the principles espoused in 974.06 or Escalona apply.
Thank you. Mr. LaBelle. Thank you, Ms. Wellman, for your arguments on a Chapter 980 case. We've had a number of such cases, but not this particular issue. So that ends our hearing on 03-2306, State versus Bush. And the students should remain. They will be joined by other students. Everyone else is welcome to attend a session with Justice Butler discussing the procedures of this court. We are in recess until 1:30.